Money Matters with Alfred Edmond Jr.
Can you really afford to spend $27,000 on a wedding? I'm Alfred Edmond Jr. More after this.
Sending money to a college student with Western Union feels. Winning $10,000, now that feels. Be automatically entered for a chance to win $10,000 when you send money across town or within the U.S. for as little as $5 from participating agent locations or WesternUnion.com. Western Union, moving money for better.
No purchase necessary. Subject to official rules at WesternUnion.com/scholarsweeps. Excludes transfers to inmate commissary accounts. Void where prohibited. Sweepstakes ends 10-7-2012.
Last year, millions of parents discovered they were their teen's drug dealer. That's because 70% of teens who abuse prescription drugs get them from family and friends. Even more shocking, prescription pain relievers have contributed to more overdose deaths than street drugs such as cocaine and heroin. Safeguard your medicine and talk with your kids about the dangers of medicine abuse. Join the Medicine Abuse Project and help this epidemic. Visit drugfree.org to learn more. A message from the partnership of drugfree.org. Money Matters, brought to you by Nationwide Insurance. Join the nation that puts members first. Nationwide is on your side.
We're back with Money Matters. I'm Alfred Edmond Jr. According to Brides Magazine, the average couple will spend nearly $27,000 on their wedding in 2012. If you can really afford it, fine. But going into debt to pay for a wedding is a terrible way to start a marriage. In fact, it's often a first step toward the financial problem symptomatic of many divorces. The following pieces of money saving advice are for those still in the planning stages for their wedding. Save on flowers by using whatever's in season for your wedding. If your heart is set on calla lilies, for example, and they're out of season for your wedding date, you'll spend a whole lot more. Also, skip retail florists and shop with wholesalers and farmers markets in your area and online. Save money by doing a breakfast or lunch reception instead of dinner, or offering a self-serve buffet instead of plated service. You can also save by limiting or eliminating alcohol at the reception, which is especially easy to do for breakfast or lunch affairs. Finally, don't be afraid to delay the honeymoon until you can afford to pay for it without putting additional financial strain on your new marriage. I'm Alfred Edmond Jr. for Money Matters, a product of American Urban Radio Networks.
A penny saved, a dollar stretched. However you measure your hard-earned money, you'll find great value at Midas. From advanced engine diagnostics and major repairs to oil changes, brakes and tires, trust the experts at Midas to give you more. With service options that respect you and your budget, all under one convenient roof. Midas. Total car care. Total customer care.
Most vehicles at participating Midas.
Premiering Saturday on OWN.
Not on my watch. Will you disrespect another woman?
Yonla Van Zandt.
You've been gone 3.5 years. Tell the truth.
He's on a mission.
Superstar husband. Spotlight camera.
To fix.
Let's call a thing, people.
Broken lives.
I'm angry because I'm choosing to suffer.
You are a hot mess.
Yonla Fix My Life premieres Saturday at 10, 9 central from the heart of OWN. To find OWN on your TV, visit oprah.com/findOWN.
The views and opinions expressed by the guests, listeners, and hosts of any show on 900 AM WURD do not necessarily reflect those of ownership, management, or advertisers of this station.
Bring it in.
Got my boy making hits, and though life seems to piss, I can straighten it out for you. Big man, big talk, big sound. Kind of round, but I guess down, because I'm...
Nick Talavero, the Nick Talavero Show.
The Nick Talavero Show.
sensation. I rock the nation, and my deliberation, the consideration of my mind reflects on time and bends it back to a time when you couldn't even reflect on what I was thinking. Didn't know what that was, but I laid it out for you. Said I'm I just can't help it. That's the way I was made. I really can't help it. That's the way the tracks were laid. I can't help it. See, that's why I get paid. That's what I said. Watch me now. Better yet, the radio, listen to it. From 4 o'clock to 7, I'm your little slice of heaven. I'm your radio Revan, and I keep shoving this stuff right at you, don't I? All right, that's it. And just like that, ladies and gentlemen, we are underway once again for our voyage of radio programming excellence here on WURD AM 900. How are you? My name is Nick Taliaferro, and I'm glad to make your acquaintance. And hopefully, before the day ends, I'll get an opportunity to spend a little time in dialogue with you or with some folks just like you across the Delaware Valley and points beyond through the courtesy, of course, of our website, www.900amwurd. And we'll be talking today about a subject that looms large in the consciousness of American society. This is the 11th anniversary of 9/11, a day that lives in infamy and a day that has shaped our perspective on life in this world, not simply in this country. It changed the way we live. It changed the way we see ourselves and the way we see others. And you know what? This is one of these times, folks, where I think it might be healthy for us to start with a real quick telephone poll. I mean, a real quick gathering of the people. And these calls are going to be no more than a minute or two, because I want to ask you a quick question. Before we get started today, I want to ask you a question as to what your recollection was on 9/11. When you think back to that day, it was not too different from the day that we see this day. The weather was close to being the same. The skies were relatively clear. And suddenly, death rained from the sky. And it changed us. It changed us significantly. We are still living in the shadow of that day. And I'm wondering, I mean, if some of you, if maybe five or six of you could call in real quick and just give me a few words in recollection of that day, what you remember about it, where you were, or what your thoughts were, or what your fears were, or what your pain was, or if you may have lost someone, or if perhaps you thought that you knew things that you did not know. We'll take a real quick telephone poll on this. This doesn't count against your call total. If you want to call in, this is not even considered a call. This is just a quick check-in. I want to shape our conversation to come through some real quick dialogue with some of our listeners at the beginning. 215-634-8065. Now, in a few moments, we're going to be speaking with two representatives of an organization that many of you may have heard of. And for those of you who haven't heard, I am pleased to introduce to you the Council on American-Islamic Relations, also known as CARE. And in the studio today will be two individuals representing that organization. One, Ms. Rugiada Conte, who is the Director for Communications and Outreach, and the other, Ms. Amara Chaudhry, who is the organization's attorney and their civil rights lawyer. These two ladies will be speaking to us about the progress that we've made, or if we haven't made progress, the journey that we've been on when it comes to the relationships that exist between Americans who may be of Christian origin and Americans who are of Islamic origin or who have Islam as their background in this country, and the progress that yet needs to be made. We'll be talking with these two representatives, and hopefully we'll be able to shape a conversation that will help us to at least see what needs to be done, what has been done, where mistakes have been made. Perhaps we'll clear up some misapprehensions. I'm hoping that this will be one of those kind of conversations that will help us to shape a society that is more understanding, more accepting, a society that views people who might happen to be different in a way that is appreciative rather than fearful or rather than frightening. 215-634-8065 is our number here in the studio. If you happen to be local, if you're outside of the Philadelphia local calling area, you can, of course, speak to us by dialing 866-361-0900. That's 866-361-0900. And we'll just give you about a minute or so to say, I remember on 9/11 that I was, or I remember on 9/11 that I felt, or I remember on 9/11 my fear was, or I still think back to that time because that's when, whatever the case might be. Now, let me tell you what my story was on 9/11. First, it was just, it was unthinkable. The idea of planes being used as weapons was unthinkable. And the idea that terrorism was at the heart of it was not far away. As soon as we realized, wait a minute, this might be terrorism. But what happened afterwards began to shock me. The level of vitriol, animosity, animus, and pure hatred shown toward people who even appear to be of an Islamic background. It shocked me. I didn't think that America could become so hate-fueled so quickly. The death of an individual of Sikh background, a young man who happened to be Sikh. And for those of you who don't understand what I'm saying, S-I-K-H is the word. These are individuals who are from the Asian area who happened to wear turbans, and people assumed that this young man was Muslim, and someone killed him for that. It was insane to me. I could not believe that people could become so hate-fueled so quickly. We began to, during that time, we began to shape ourselves by our fears and by our anger and by our rage. And for a while, the United States became an unhealthy place in trying to deal with its own pain. I will not forget that. It was a time of great grief, a sense of great loss, but also a sense of great coming together. That's what I recall from 9/11. And hopefully some of you good folks will be able to share your perspective as well. While we're talking about this here in the United States of America, something has happened overseas that once again causes us to face ourselves and ask some questions. Over in Egypt, in Cairo, some activists of whatever the sort might be scaled the walls of the United States Embassy on this anniversary of the attack and began to desecrate and destroy the American flag. What will that do for relations? We already know that there's a lot of tension in Egypt. I was scheduled to be in Egypt during the time of the Egyptian Revolution, and unfortunately or fortunately, I could not go. But the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which is considered to be more aggressive in their stance toward the United States and more, shall we say, I don't want to use the word radical because I think it's been overused, but the Muslim Brotherhood has secured a large number of seats in the Egyptian government. And now there is the fear that Egypt, having long been an ally of the United States of America, might begin to reposition itself to become a part of a group of nations that are somewhat antithetical and opposed to the United States and also Israel. For better or for worse, the United States is known to be or is assumed to be a friend of Israel to the extent that regardless as to what Israel may do, that the United States is bound to stand by their side. That, of course, means that it creates extra tension in that region. We are living in a world that has become a powder keg. And at any given moment, the flames can be fanned to become a conflagration. And this world that we have assumed might be peaceful for ourselves and our children could once again be swept up in the type of global warfare that we saw back in the 1940s and previous to that, that we saw at the turn of the centuries in World War I. But this time, the global warfare would be accompanied by the capacity to destroy ourselves several times over. There's a time for deep reflection and thought. There's a time for consideration. There's a time for good people like ourselves, those of us who engage in dialogue during this time at WRD on the Nick Taliaferro Show. It's a time for us to assert ourselves and to assert the peace that we wish to see in the world so that individuals who long for war and who shape their worldview by their fears so that those individuals will not rule the day. It's very important for us to become conversant with the issues, to dialogue about them, and then to become assertive when it comes to trying to create and to build peace. You can't always have peace, but you want to try to build it as much as you possibly can. It is 18 minutes after the hour of 4 o'clock here on your favorite conversation station, WRD AM 900. This is the Nick Taliaferro Show. In just a few moments, we will be joined by two representatives from the organization CARE, which is the acronym that stands for the Council for American-Islamic Relations, and the person of the Director of Outreach and Communications, Ruggiata Conte, and in the person of their civil rights attorney, Ms. Amara Chaudhry. They will both be in the studio with us, and the conversation will ensue directly thereafter. We are hoping that you will join us in that conversation as time goes on so that we can kind of begin to flesh out where we've been and where we need to go as far as improving our relationships in this country, specifically as it regards those individuals who are of Islamic background and the rest of this nation who may happen to be of either Christian background or maybe none at all. People assume that America is a Christian country, and it actually is not. It is a republic that supposedly stands on the principle of the separation between the powers of religion and the powers of the state. But recently, we seem to have done some turns. We'll talk more about that in just a few moments. 19 minutes after the hour of 4 o'clock. Why don't we get an early start on the traffic? It looks like things are turning nicely out there. Let's check it out for ourselves, and then we will come back and begin our conversation with you and our guests directly thereafter.
Our situation on the Northeast Extension remains pretty much as it has been as far as the lane configuration is concerned, but at least the volume is lessening somewhat. This traffic report brought to you by Garmin. All through the midday hours today, we've had the left lane blocked southbound on the Northeast Extension at mile marker 24.8. That's where they've been doing some emergency construction work to fix a big hole in the bridge. At this point, they're just waiting for the concrete to cure before they can reopen that lane. It's just about a 10-minute delay behind it, though, much better than it had been. Schuylkill Expressway eastbound slowing, 202 into Gulf Mills, again from the Boulevard in through Vine. The westbound side backs up University through Vine, then for the Boulevard to Belmont. And northbound on the Roosevelt Boulevard, where you're slow from Wissahickon Avenue up to Broad Street. Southbound Route 1 in Bucks County, slowing just south of Street Road, an accident being worked on there. Eastbound Vine Expressway solid the entire way from the Schuylkill into 95, and northbound 95 ties up Penn's Landing up through Girard. Hate traffic? Don't be a hater. Get a Garmin Nuvi with subscription-free HD digital traffic and avoid it with updates as often as every 30 seconds. Drive with Garmin, the most trusted name in GPS. For more traffic information, go to sigalert.com. I'm Randy Chepigan with your Philadelphia area traffic.
And welcome back to you, ladies and gentlemen, 21 minutes after the hour, 4 o'clock, here on your favorite conversation station in America's favorite city. This is WURD AM 900, and you're listening to the Nick Taliaferro Show. My name, of course, is Nick Taliaferro Show, and that's why we connect together so well. How about we give you a word on the weather? And, of course, this time a temperature check is being brought to you by WURD's 990 membership drive. The campaign is still going on strong all the way up until October. You can be a part of the family. family. And of course, being a part of this family gives you all sorts of privileges that you can enjoy. And part of those privileges are to benefit from discounts that are allowed by some of the merchants who partner with us here at WRD. If you'd like to be a member of the WRD family, give us a call at 215-425-7875 and say to one of our team members, hey, Nick said we can become members of the family. And of course, we'll let you in. You can be a part of us too. All of us here got a little bit of something special going on, and you'll find yourself right at home with us. And if you don't want to give us a call, you can go online and check us out at 900amwrd.com. That's www.900amwrd.com. And now, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls and children of all ages, how about we give you a word on the weather? A word, once again, today is beautiful. It is absolutely gorgeous outside. 75 warm degrees on this September day. Just a precursor of the beautiful fall weather that is yet to come. Partly cloudy outside, just some streaky clouds there. Nothing to be afraid of or concerned about. Tonight, the temperatures will go down to 55 beautiful sleeping degrees here in America's favorite city. And tomorrow, you can anticipate a day that looks a whole lot like this one. It will be 81 degrees tomorrow during the afternoon, once again with clear skies, a few streaks out there just to kind of give you a little coloration. And later on in the evening, it goes down to 58 degrees in the city of Philadelphia. Beautiful sleeping weather for the next couple of days. You folks, I got to tell you, this weather was made to order. You can't go wrong with the kind of weather that we've been facing for the last couple of days. It is special order directly by your folks here at WURD, and we are hoping that you will appreciate the fact that we've ordered this weather just for you. You're listening to your favorite conversation station in America's favorite city, WURD AM 900. My name is Nick Taliaferro. They keep telling me that, and I keep signing the checks that they write out that way, and so I'm sticking to that story until such time as things change. All right, on this beautiful day, folks, we count back 11 years to a time when we were startled into a new state of consciousness back when planes fell from the sky. From that time on, we redefined ourselves in America as us and as them. And them was anybody that we xenophobically decided that we needed to fear. And a large part of those that we thought we should fear were people who were of a certain religious background. Since that time, we have had to face our xenophobia. We've had to face our hatred. We've had to face, our prejudice and our bigotry. And once again, America recognized that we are prone to go way off the scale when fears come into the picture. Today, we want to talk about the progress that has been made or the lack of progress that may have been made when it comes to relationships between Muslim Americans and Americans of a different stripe. And here to help us flesh out that discussion are two representatives of the Council for American Islamic Relations, Ms. Amari Chaudhry, who is the civil rights attorney for CARE, and the Director for Outreach and Communication, Ms. Rugiada Conte. Did I get both of those names right? Let me make sure that I get these microphones right in front of both of you ladies so that the dulcet tones of your voice will not be lost in the ether world. First of all, did I say both of your names right?
Well, I would just have to make one correction. It's Rugiati. It's hard G.
It's a hard G. Here I am thinking that I'm being fancy, you know.
Rugiatu.
Yeah, so it's Rugiatu Conte. Right. First of all, I think it's very poetic, itself. Rugiatu Conte. And did I get your name correct?
Name perfectly, so I'm all kinds of impressed.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the show ends right there. It can only get worse for me after that, being impressed. But it's good to have you both with us and to share this day with you as we talk about the relationship that exists between Muslim Americans and their counterparts. Sometimes they're Christians, sometimes they're not. Let's start at the, I'll use the word beginning for a better term. 9/11, 11 years ago, this country found itself facing a schism based upon perceptions that some people had about Muslims and Muslim Americans. How far have we come from that point till now?
Well, I think I'll just kind of reverse back and say, like, immediately after 9/11, you found that within the Pennsylvania Muslim community, you had different kind of reactions. So you have people who look like the Muslim stereotype, so people of Middle Eastern descent or South Asian descent, who you found kind of facing more discrimination. And then you have small pockets of other groups or larger groups who are Muslim. So like for myself, I come from an African background, West African background. And within that community,
may I ask which country?
From Liberia. Yeah. From Liberia.
All right.
So my parents were came from Liberia. They came to America, particularly Philadelphia, in the 80s. So you have the Pennsylvania Muslim community is very, very diverse. So what you found are basically leaders from different communities coming together and saying, look, we're finding that people in our community, they're experiencing different types of discrimination. And they came together in 2004, and that's when CARE was formed. So you found the cases that they dealt with initially, a lot of that had to do with employment discrimination. So for example, a lady, a Muslim woman, would be in her job and her supervisor would say, okay, I want you to take off hijab. And
for those who don't know, could you tell everyone what a hijab is?
Thank you so much.
Sure.
I kind of forget that people don't know. A head covering.
Okay.
So those were the type of cases that they initially got around 2004. And there were some other cases as well, and some other prison cases, especially being in this area. But now we see more effects of government policy on people's daily lives. And I think that Amara will talk more about that.
Yes, I will. And actually, I'm going to go back. Your original question was, how far have we come?
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about the immediate aftermath. And I'm going to actually, rather than focusing on the immediate aftermath of 9/11, I want to talk about the lasting effects of 9/11 on how we live our lives as Americans today. Now, I'm a lawyer. I got to put out there right straight up.
That's okay. We still like you.
Yeah, I want to focus upon the legal ramifications today, because what we have to remember is that 9/11 did not happen in a vacuum. It happened within the context of larger American history, and in particular within the context of America's racial history. Now, in the United States, there is a long-standing and very well-studied presumptions of criminality amongst people of color and dark-skinned persons. So 9/11 happens. I know that very few people know what the original hijackers look like, but it seems like a bunch of dark-skinned foreign people come over, harm America. And since then, we've seen an increasingly a presumptive criminalization of American Muslim identity. It's based upon an increasing racialization of American Muslim identity, and it's consistent with long-standing, well-studied presumptions that persons with dark skin can have a propensity for violence and violence-driven criminal activity. So how do you see America responding to that? So we assume that dark-skinned people are dangerous. We assume that Muslims are dangerous because we have racialized this category. You see manifestations in several ways. One, and probably the most noticeable amongst our community, is FBI surveillance of American Muslims, both within religious institutions such as mosques, as well as other community organizations. We saw the NYPD surveillance of both mosques and Muslim student groups. There is anti-American Muslim profiling at the borders and at airports. We've seen anti-Muslim trainings conducted by law enforcement and the military.
What was the attention shown at airports? Did that precede 9/11, or was that something that was created by 9/11?
So all of these things, you know, that's a question of the chicken or the egg.
Yeah.
Which came from which? But I believe we definitely see a spike in activity.
Oh, of course.
In the post 9/11 world. And truth be told, you know, when I talk about how 9/11 did not happen in a vacuum, there was already this anti-Muslim bias in America, which was predicated upon the fact that the perception was that Muslims come from this particular part of the world. We'll call it the Greater Middle East here. And those people are dangerous. And I want to point out to you, when we're talking about criminality being associated with certain racial ethnic groups, Muslims are not alone in this, right? And neither are African Americans, most of the listeners. When the feds want to go looking for organized crime, they want to investigate and prosecute RICO violations, mm-hmm. what community did they go to? We know.
Italian, didn't
they? Right. Yeah. You know, okay. when they want to look for white collar crime, where do they go? They're going to look at Jewish Americans. I mean,
oh, okay.
this is not
glad some, you answered that one for me.
Well, but
I
this is not
that one up.
Unique yeah. to the American Muslim community, but it is a common thread we see amongst persons who do not appear to be Northern, Western, European in ancestry. I don't believe that the religious component is as strong as the racial ethnic
That's
components.
What I was going to ask you, and I'm glad you introduced that. At one point, it appeared that the prejudice and the animus shown toward people who were of Muslim orientation was more religious. It was, you know, you worship a God that we don't know and in a way that we don't understand. And so it's the religious factor. But you're saying now that the prejudice and the alienation is more now racial?
I believe so. I know Ruki wants to weigh in, too. Do you want to weigh in now? Because I've been talking a lot.
I definitely want to weigh in. I think a good, probably, example would be the recent Disney case where a Disney employee was harassed by her supervisors.
I remember
and
that one, yeah.
I think that a really good, I was reading the article, and it just blew my mind because the people, her supervisors call her Osama. They called her...
Are you serious?
Yeah, they call her different things. But at the end, they said that they called her Kunta Kinte. Now, this is... This is mind-blowing. This is someone who comes from Middle Eastern descent. She doesn't look black at all. And her supervisors decided to call her Kunta Kinte. So I'm sitting down thinking, like, this is the same old hate or bigotry that we're seeing on another level.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated issue, and we can see it both ways. On one hand, you do have, at least from a law enforcement perspective, a concentration upon the extent to which individuals practice mm-hmm. the Islamic mm-hmm. faith, because if you practice more, you're more dangerous. So that does seem to be a religious taint.
Right.
And that's intriguing in and of itself.
The more devout you are, the more dangerous you are.
Right.
And I think...
Hadn't thought about that.
Talk about...
I think that's one of the biggest travesty of 9/11. It doesn't make any type of sense. It's pretty absurd. So you have different myths about Muslims. You have the belief that the more religious you are, the more prone you are towards terrorist activities. And that's where you find our government surveilling mosques and other religious bases.
Right.
But I think the word radical and Islam kind of go together in many people's minds.
But I want to flip it around. And that you're speaking to another interesting point. So that what I was just saying, the studying of the mosque, asking people how much they pray as an element of determining whether you are somebody we need to look at as law enforcement, suggests a religious aspect. It also circumvents America's general ickiness factor around racial profiling, because there's this argument...
Ickiness? Is that a legal
that's
term?
That's not a legal term. But, you know,
ickiness, okay.
We know that in a pre-9/11 world, poll data year after year after year was very opposed to racial profiling. The average American hated this idea. The Supreme Court never really picked up on it, but... There were movements in Congress to pass comprehensive anti-racial profiling law, and it all changed post 9/11. But the flip side of it, when you talk about how radical and Islam go hand in hand, it dovetails into the other myth. And we actually have seen this from, for example, PowerPoint presentations from federal law enforcement trainings, where there is this stated argument that there is no such thing as a moderate Muslim. Now,
That is a truism to some people in government, that there's no such thing as a moderate Muslim?
Some people. Then, of course, you know, of course, their bosses are always distancing themselves. And they're like, I don't know where that came from. You know, and we got a disclaimer and we got all these other things. But, I mean, there is that mantra in general society that there's no such thing as a moderate Muslim, that people who appear moderate are pretending to be moderate in order mm-hmm. to court favor. Now, think about what that's really saying. Because think about it, like, if the extent to which I practice my faith is not determinative about whether I'm Muslim or not, what is the origin of Muslim identity? And it gets linked to a racial ethnic identity. It's similar to the concept in Nazi Germany that Jewish identity was linked to grandparents, lineage, and faith and things like that. And if you converted out of Judaism, you were still a Jew.
Right.
If something other than the extent to which I practice my faith is the source of my Muslim identity, then I can try converting out, I'm still a Muslim. There's sort of that sentiment there, that if you're born one, you are one.
So, you know, so a Muslim American, the American part is just telling everybody your location. The fact of the matter is that if you're Muslim, you're still somewhere else and still opposed to American values. Is that
what? I think that's the general belief.
I mean, just to go back to President Obama, obviously we all know that his father was Muslim, but people cannot get it out of their heads that he's not Muslim. You know?
Right.
So that kind of goes back to what you were saying.
Right. I mean, they think he was kind of born under circumstances that he's a hidden Muslim. So he can go to church.
He's a secret agent. Yeah.
Right.
Well, and that doesn't change the fact that he's really a Muslim.
So you two ladies who are both American citizens, I'm assuming correctly?
Yes.
Okay. You two ladies are both American citizens. Even though you make your living here, you this is home for your family. Are you suggesting or are you asserting that people will still see you as alien and foreign and hostile simply because your religion is Islam or Muslim?
Do you answer?
I want to go back and say yes. We are citizens, not only that, but we were born and raised here. And I guess certain people, I believe...
You were born here.
Right, I was born here. Okay. I was born in Philly.
Okay.
Yep.
So you're homegirl.
Yeah, I am.
Okay, all right. But yet, because you wear a hijab, people will view you as being other, even though you are here.
Yeah, it's very interesting because... It is interesting because I haven't always worn hijab. And you have the different experience. I just recently started wearing it probably about 6 years ago. So the majority of my life, I haven't worn it. And... even with my identity, obviously I've always been Muslim, but before I had it on, people perceived me to be African.
Okay.
But then when I started to wear hijab, all the other identities kind of went away and people perceived me to be Muslim, and that's the kind of the dominant identity. So, I mean, to go back to your question, I think that I had a lot of relationships which unfortunately ended when I started to quote unquote practice. And that goes back to the myth of the more religious,
the more devout you are.
Right. You are a threat somehow.
I wanted to weigh in as well because you asked, are you perceived as being foreign? I think that's probably even more the case for me. And I know I've spoken with Rugi about this before, and Nick, I spoke to you a little bit about it before the show. You know, America understands race according to a black-white binary,
right. Mm-hmm.
And if you do not fit neatly into that, you're either lying because you're on that binary and you're just not telling people the truth,
mm-hmm.
or you must be foreign. And it's very interesting when you ask, you know, whether we were both born and raised here and, you know, we were, but Rugi just spoke very eloquently about how her family immigrated from Liberia in the 1980s. And I will have to say, I mean, to me, it's very clear that you're of West African ancestry and not African American. I would not look at you and guess that you were African American.
Really?
But, I mean, that's probably just my perception of things. I can definitely see West African features on you.
Can we, for just a moment, okay.
Can I just keep going? Sure. I'm going on this. But okay. I'm going to say people...
I'd never stop a lawyer.
Continue. People react to me very much as being immigrant because I am South Asian ancestry, but she was speaking about how her family came in the 1980s. Well, but my family predates hers in the United States.
Really?
But, yeah, they came in the 1960s, which was the big influx of immigration from the Indian subcontinent.
Can you tell people where your parents are from?
My parents are from Lahore, Pakistan. Ethnically, both sides of the family come from Sialkot, Pakistan. But they immigrated. My father came first to Blacksburg, Virginia, to pursue his PhD at Virginia Tech. So I grew up in Appalachian Virginia as an American of Pakistani ancestry. But
that just had to be so enjoyable for you.
It was very pleasant. But yeah. When we're talking about being perceived as foreign, so there are two realities. One is the first half of my life growing up in Appalachia where we have these preconceived ideas of what Appalachia is like, and it's very admittedly not a racially tolerant society.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way to deny that. But at the same time, I was not perceived as foreign in that environment because they just decided I must exist on the black-white binary. Let's just decide that Amara is you know, an African-American person who happens to be, like many Virginian African-Americans, light-skinned, straight-haired.
Okay.
Blah, blah, blah. But it goes back to now I moved to Philadelphia, and people are always asking me, were you born here? And I wonder if people in Radioland can hear it more than people who are looking at me. But, you know, I fly constantly to overcome a very native Southern accent. So people always will tell me when they hear me
audio.
Did
you have a Southern accent at one time?
Pretty thick one.
I can't
and so,
imagine.
But it still goes to this idea that being Muslim or even coming from the greater Middle East somehow makes me less American than Rugi is. And I wanted to bring up that statistic, the 1960s immigration statistic, for a reason. When CARE and other Muslim organizations put forth our demographic information of the Muslim community, we always present the fact that the Muslim community is majority immigrant, because about 60-some percent are non-native born, 40% are native born. CARE did a study back in 2006, which I looked at recently, that broke it down by the number of years you've been in this country. And when you looked at even the American Muslims who were born abroad, the largest segment had been here 20 or more years, with the largest influx, population influx, being in the 1960s. So even the American Muslim immigrants are people who've been here four decades or longer. That's a very important thing for Americans to understand, because there's this perception that we're always immigrant. You know, Islam came to America on the slave ships. We know that the slave ships arrived in America in 1619. We've got to get away from this theory that this is a new religion.
You know, this is getting very interesting. We've got to take a quick pause to check in with traffic, and I'm sure that people are going to want to start calling and asking questions. And folks, let me tell you, I'm just getting warmed up here. I've got a whole ton of questions to ask, and they've got a lot to talk about. As we were preparing for the show, these two guests were helping me to understand that I was going to start the show, and then they were going to go ahead and help me to shape it, and I would just run out, and they would go ahead. They can carry this thing all by themselves. A real dialogue is going to ensue. You're listening to WRD AM 900. This is the Nick Taliaferro Show. My name is Nick Taliaferro. You already know who you are. When we come back, we'll engage in dialogue and conversation with our guests, Amari Chaudhry, and also Rugiatu Kantu. Did I say? I'm getting closer. Kante.
Exactly.
Kante. Yes. And with a name like Nick Taliaferro, I'm trying real hard, folks. We'll be right back after this. Stay with us.
Normal amount of volume this afternoon. A few additional trouble spots, too. This traffic report brought to you by Garmin. Trouble spot that's been with us since the end of the morning rush hours on the southbound Northeast Extension. At mile marker 24.8, the left lane is still blocked there. The scene of some earlier emergency construction work. They're still just waiting for the concrete to cure before they'll be able to reopen that left lane. Further south on the Blue Route, 476, slowing from St. David's down to Broomall. Northbound tied up just north of 95, as usual. East on the Schuylkill Expressway, we're backed up from 202 into Gulf Mills, then 476 to Gladwin, even more dense from the Boulevard in through Vine. And the westbound side backs up University through Vine, then from the Boulevard out to Belmont. Solid traffic east on the Vine Expressway all the way across from the Schuylkill in through 95. And north on 95 slows from Penn's Landing up through Girard. Hate traffic? Don't be a hater. Get a Garmin Nuvi with subscription-free HD digital traffic and avoid it with updates as often as every 30 seconds. Drive with Garmin, the most trusted name in GPS. For more traffic information, go to SigAlert.com. I'm Randy Chepigan with your Philadelphia area traffic.
Kwanzaa 360 Directory, Third Element Spa Salon, located at 7175 Ogontz Avenue, invites you to their full-service spa. The Third Element Spa Salon specializes in nails, skin, hair, and body treatments. Can't get there? The Third Element Spa Salon will come to you. Call now, 215-276-2633. That's 215-276-2633. Kwanzaa 360 Directory. Pick up your Kwanzaa 360 merchandise here at the station, 1341 North Delaware Avenue, Suite 300, between the hours of 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. Kwanzaa 360 t-shirts, mugs, and wristbands make the perfect gift for you or someone else. Kwanzaa 360 Directory. Get your business listed in the Kwanzaa 360 Directory. Call 215-425-7875.
The thought of my sons growing up without me inspired me to quit smoking.
I talked to my doctors, and then I threw away all my cigarettes, ashtrays, and lighters.
I started exercising instead of smoking.
Getting support from friends online kept me on track.
Staying away from alcohol when I was first quitting was key.
Instead of smoking after I ate, I'd get up and take a walk.
I missed having a cigarette in my hand, so I'd hold a pen or a straw, anything.
Until I knew I wouldn't give in to temptation, I spent more time with my friends who didn't smoke.
I went to places that were smoke-free.
I didn't stay quit the very first time I tried.
I kept on trying, and I learned something each time.
Do whatever it takes.
No matter how many times it takes.
I quit.
I quit.
I quit.
We did it. So can you.
You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
Minutes away from the hour, 5 o'clock in America's favorite city. You're listening to WURD AM 900. How in the world are you doing? My name's Nick Taliaferro, and this is the Nick Taliaferro Show on your favorite conversation station, WURD AM 900. Glad that you locked your dial right here. The conversation is going to stir the drink of the Delaware Valley for the next couple of hours, and we're going to be talking with two fascinating guests who really have led me into places of consideration and thought that I did not think my mind would be capable of going today. They are both representatives of the Council for American Islamic Relations, the group called CARE, in the person of Ms. Rugiada Conte. I got that right that time, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Ladies and gentlemen, I get a star for that one, who is the Director of Outreach and Communication, and Ms. Amara Chaudhry, who is the Civil Rights Attorney and the organization's Attorney of Record. Am I saying that correctly? Is that your actual title? Or
it's actually Civil Rights Director and Staff Attorney, but you were close enough for government work.
You know what? I'm taking all I can get. And this microphone, they can move back a little bit if you want to, you know, like lean back and whatever. We were talking, I mean, just to summarize a little bit, and there's no way that I can summarize in a sentence or two all that we shared, but one of the things that we became very clear on is this, that even though you two ladies both were born in America, have lived in America, been educated in America, you are still suspect because your orientation as a matter of faith is Muslim. Would that be correct?
When you say orientation, I guess to me, I would say it because our primary identity is Muslim. Because as a matter of faith, I know that Rugi practices more and more strictly observes the faith. I have historically not, but that does not undercut the fact that my identity is primarily Muslim. Yeah.
But people would not assume that you were Muslim.
I mean, that's correct, but once they know, like Rugi mentioned, like relationships die pretty quickly.
Once they know you're Muslim, they suddenly, because, I mean, you're... And what folks, because I know this is color radio, but you folks cannot see our guests. You cannot see their complexions. You cannot see how they are attired, except for those of you who might be tuned in. There's a camera right there, Rugiada, and it shows who we are. But for the most of us, you can't see them, and so you cannot tell that Rugiada is of a browner complexion. She's wearing a hijab, which is the headscarf that you see with many women. She is from Liberia originally, but if I just saw you on the street, I would think you were just a sister from my neighborhood.
Yeah, it's interesting because you said I'm originally from Liberia, and I'm not. I'm originally from Philadelphia, but my parents
are from Liberia.
Your family,
yes. Well, I've already been called racist.
I had to call you out on that.
I tell you, it's just going to be a bad day for the kid. But okay, you are an American. You were born and raised in Philadelphia, and I would not think that you were I would think that you were an African-American just like I was, born and raised in this country, and that your parents are descended from people who once were from Africa. I would not think that you were just once removed from Liberia. I wouldn't know that, even though Amara said that you would think that, you would see that.
Right. I mean, I think that's been my experience. Like, because even growing up, I went to a predominantly... it was a very diverse school, middle school, and then I went to high school. I went to girls' high. And then went to Temple. So, I mean, my experience is that I knew that I was African. People did know that I was different. So my experience has been that African-Americans perceived me to be different.
Now, I noticed you just said that you knew that you were African, even though you were born in Philadelphia, America.
Right,
so
right.
I had to call you out on that.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. We'll just go back and forth.
Go back and forth on that one. Well, on the other hand, Amara, am I saying your name correctly?
Yep, you're saying it perfectly. Okay.
People would see you and they would see a person of lighter caramel-colored complexion, with straighter hair, and they could assume a wide number of things about you. They could think, as I was saying, they could think that you were of Mexican descent. They could think that you were of Indian descent. They could think that you were Trinidadian. I mean, you could go to anybody's party and immediately be accepted as some part of somebody's family. So they don't know that you're Muslim. But as soon as they do know, you say, they quickly categorize you and suddenly... the paradigm shifts.
Yeah, I mean, there's a quick categorization so that stereotypes start to be applied to you. There has been, and, you know, I worked, prior to coming to care in my past life, I worked in government for a very long time.
Okay.
And when I try to contact old contacts, I've actually had the experience where I was talking about a Muslim civil rights issue to a man who I'd known for years, and he, at some point in the conversation, he was like, you know, at first, he took the call because he knows that I have been associated with what he would call leftist causes for a while. So it's a civil rights issue. He's going with me. But then he was like, yeah, I mean, you seem to have a special interest in this. What's this about? And then I saw the sound of his voice switch. He said, you're not Muslim, are you? And I said, yes. Yes, I am. Well, have you always been? Yes. Yes, I have. And the contact actually stopped. Like he would not return calls. And, I mean, there's... that sort of a thing. There's such a, it's not, it would be more forgiving that people apply some stereotypes, like maybe they ask you some stupid, ignorant questions or something, but then you get a chance to address it, rather than just the level of hatred or even maybe just political fear that says, I have to dissociate from somebody who just happens to have a Muslim identity. And for me, it's a little bit different. You know, we have been talking, and I think CARE is cognizant of the extent to which Muslim identity in the United States, even amongst African-American Muslims, we haven't really talked about it yet, is a combination of racial, ethnic, and religious identity.
Right.
But, you know, so in that context, people identify as being Muslim for different reasons. Some people for cultural reasons, some people for religious reasons. It's not totally different from the way American Jews identify Jewish identity.
Yeah, and some even for political reasons. I mean, there is a geopolitical perspective. Yeah. That's what I was going to ask now. When a person identifies as Muslim, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're religiously observant. So what does it mean when someone says, I am Muslim? And a Muslim American in particular.
I mean, the thing is, like you said, or Amara said, is that people have different reasons for saying that. So, like, for some people, they are religiously observant. For some people, they come from Muslim families. For some people, it's a national identity. So I think that it's the same in other religions as well, where you have a vast array of different opinions and different views about things and then different identities.
Yeah, and I'll give you the example there. There is somebody in my life who identifies very, very strongly as Jewish, but is non-observant.
Okay.
And actually is not looking forward to the high holidays. Just, you know, he doesn't normally...
It's next week for him, isn't it?
I know, right? Yeah. It's time to get on board already. But anyway, and yet he identifies very strongly as Jewish. And yet if I were to... And I have approached him about it and be like, well, what does that mean for you? Does that mean an ethnic identity?
Mm-hmm.
He gets very upset. Well, but what is it then? If you're not religious, if it's not that. But there is a similar set of complicated beliefs, complicated, very individualized personal beliefs within our community, and also a difference of opinion about what observance means. So somebody may very truly believe, because when I say, I use the word observant when I was differentiating myself with Rugi, because obviously, you know, you can now see that she wears a headscarf. I do not. I walked in with a sleeveless blouse. you know, she's covered all these kinds of things. But in my mind, I'm following the pillars. I observe the faith.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's a difference of opinion there.
And there's different views. Yeah. But that could be safe. I mean, that could be said for other religions as well. Yeah.
Before we get to the top of the hour and we get on news break, we will start lining up calls for you. Those of you who might wish to engage in this dialogue can join us at 215-634-8065 here in the city of Philadelphia. Once again, the number is 215-634-8065. And if you happen to be outside of the Philadelphia listening area and you'd like to make a toll-free call, we'll pay the freight. You do the talking at 1-866-361-0900. That's 866-361-0900. Just briefly, ladies, if we could, the group CARE. Now, some people have said, and we've already talked about the fact that people think that to be Muslim is to be, quote, radicalized, unquote. And people are saying that the group CARE is a front, as you had said earlier. One, I forget which of you said that if people appear to be quote, non-radical, that is just a front, that they're only faking so that they can become a Trojan horse and get in and do something subversive. People think that, and I've read some things where people feel that CARE was started by individuals who were part of Hamas, and that secretly that it is an organization that wants to overthrow the government. How do you respond to that? How do you get people straight on that one?
Well, of course, it does play into what I was saying, but I want to first start by talking about how CARE is organized structurally, because it is important to know that even though there is a national organization with state chapters, at the same time, CARE Philadelphia is its own separately incorporated 501c3 nonprofit.
Okay.
So there isn't even a consistent agenda amongst and across CARE chapters. There are certain ideals that are put forth by national, and we all try to honor those ideals in different ways. But you know, there have been a lot of allegations that our organization, or at least the national organization, is associated with Islamic terrorism in some capacity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I've spoken at length about it in multiple contexts, but I want to summarize it here by talking about an analogy.
Okay.
So let's go back to the civil rights movement in America. We know that the FBI was conducting surveillance on many persons and organizations.
COINTELPRO?
Yes, and I mean specific organizations. I'm talking about like the NAACP, Martin Luther King Jr., SNCC, you know, all of those organizations. And, you know, and the allegation was specifically that those organizations and individuals had been infiltrated by communism. Okay, had been infiltrated by communism. So there was this sense that these alleged civil rights organizations had been infiltrated by this dangerous foreign entity, which has as its agenda the idea of overthrowing the American government and changing our society. Now we fast forward to 2012, and the allegation is that a civil rights organization, the largest that speaks CARE. On behalf of, yes, CARE, Muslim. That speaks on behalf of American Muslims, has been infiltrated by anti-American forces with the agenda of overthrowing the government. It's the same story, a different day.
I got you. So it's just the basic fear of America imputing suspicion where there really is no need for it. We'll start taking your calls at 215-634-8065. Our guest in the studio today, Amara Chaudhry, who is the civil rights attorney for the group CARE in the city of Philadelphia, and Rugiyata Kante. Boy, I tell you, one of these days when I learn to speak English, I'm going to be dangerous. Nick Taliaferro here with you. It's 1 minute away from the hour, 5 o'clock. We'll be right back after we take this break. Stay with us.
On air, online, and in the community. 900 AM WURD, Philadelphia.
Yeah. News World this afternoon, I'm Debbie Parker. Reports say the White House has rejected a request by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to meet with President Obama this month.